embarking on a new relationship. Joe Biden promises to reset ties with the Middle East on his first tour as U.S. president. So what can he achieve? And will he be held back by political pressures at home? This is Inside Story. Hello there and welcome to the program. I'm Nastasia Tay. Now, the US is promising a new era of engagement with the Middle East. Joe Biden is making his first trip to the region since becoming president, and he'll have many issues to deal with over the next 4 days. Biden's first stop is Israel, where he's meeting acting Prime Minister Yair Lapid and former leader Benjamin Netanyahu. He'll then head to the occupied West Bank to meet Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Biden is expected to face questions about the killing of Al Jazeera correspondent Shireen Abu Akhle, who was a Palestinian-American. The U.S. State Department found that Israeli gunfire likely killed the journalist, but couldn't definitively conclude the bullet's origin. A group of Democratic senators has written an open letter saying the investigation doesn't live up to the administration's calls for an independent and credible inquiry.
Greater peace, greater stability, greater connection. It's critical. It's critical, if I might add, for all the people of the region, which is why we'll discuss my continued support, even though I know it's not in the near term, a two-state solution. That remains, in my view, the best way to ensure the future of equal measure of freedom, prosperity and democracy for Israelis and Palestinians alike.
Well, Stephanie Decker has more.
The last time President Joe Biden was here in the region was in 2010 in his capacity as vice president, trying to revive talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians. But just hours after landing here, the Israeli government announced the construction of 1,600 new settler units here in Ramat Shlomo. According to reports, it left Joe Biden furious. And publicly, he stated this was very much against what was needed to rebuild trust between the two sides. Well, now he returns as president, and Ramat Shlomo has turned into a massive illegal settlement. Now, settlements have continued to expand both here in the occupied West Bank and in occupied East Jerusalem. It's cited as one of the main obstacles to peace by the Palestinians. And under the previous Trump administration, this was never criticized. But under Biden, Washington is taking a stronger stance. President Biden, however, comes here at a time of Israeli political turmoil. He'll be meeting with the interim Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who could no longer be Prime Minister following November's elections. And he'll also be meeting with opposition leader Benjamin Netanyahu, a man he's known for a very long time. Biden will also be meeting with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas here in Bethlehem, where it's impossible to miss the wall, really the symbol of Israel's long-standing occupation and efforts to restrict the freedom of movement of the Palestinian people. But the administration has made it clear that this trip is more about integrating Israel into the region rather than reviving long-stalled peace talks.
Well, afterwards, Joe Biden will take an unprecedented direct flight from Israel to Saudi Arabia to attend a regional summit there.
We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
Well, that's what he said about the kingdom during the 2020 presidential campaign while talking about the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Biden is under pressure in the U.S. to deal with high oil prices. He and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman will attend that same summit in Jeddah, but the two are not expected to hold a bilateral meeting. Well, other items on the agenda include the Iran nuclear deal. Biden says he will continue pressuring Tehran to return to the 2015 agreement. Former President Donald Trump, you'll recall, withdrew the U.S. from that accord in 2018. In Iraq and Syria, Biden has approved the use of military force to prevent the resurgence of groups such as ISIL and to respond to rocket attacks on U.S. targets. And Washington is also pushing for negotiations to end the war in Yemen. Well, let's bring in our guests. In Arlington, Virginia, we have Khaled El-Gindi. He's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and also the author of Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians, from Balfour to Trump. From London, we're joined by Andreas Krieg, a senior lecturer in defense studies at King's College London, And in Birmingham is Scott Lucas, Professor Emeritus at Birmingham University and founder of EA Worldview, a news analysis website. A very warm welcome to you all. Thank you for joining us, gentlemen. I want to start with the timing of this. Now, Biden's last trip to the region was, what, over 12 years ago as vice president? And he's obviously been president for, what, a year and a half now. It hasn't gone unnoticed that it's taken some time for this trip to take place. Now, the administration obviously says they have plenty of reasons to be there, but given the oil price and the proximity of US midterms, I would guess that regional allies aren't under any illusions about the urgency of this visit. So let me start with you, Andreas. What's the US relationship like now with its Middle Eastern allies? I know the word transactional has been used to describe that relationship of late.
Well, yes. I think the biggest problem that the United States has at the moment is that it's too much preoccupied by domestic polarization. It's kind of almost paralyzed by what's going in Washington, the 6th of January committee. A lot of pressure also on Biden to deliver. He hasn't really delivered on much. You know, America is in an unprecedented crisis domestically. And now this trip to the Middle East is obviously coming against this backdrop. So he's kind of trying to show that, he wants to have a foreign policy success. He wants to show that in terms of energy policy, energy politics, as well as supply chain security, he's actually someone who's getting things done. But he has very little to show for what he's actually been promising. And it's also kind of doubtful that he will be able to actually show anything in terms of success on this very particular trip. Mm. So Biden is very much with a back against the wall. We've got midterm elections, as you were already saying. So people are looking at him and saying, what is he actually what does he have to show for himself? And he's entering into a region that, and that's not just a Biden problem, that for three consecutive presidents has actually been left to its own devices, and where vacuums have been filled by local players and by extra-regional players such as Russia and China as competitors of the United States. So the United States is coming as a superpower to the region, but no longer really is received on the ground and perceived on the ground as a real superpower, because it's really very impotent now.
A very different Middle East from Biden's last trip. Now, he started his trip in Israel, and his last visit obviously wasn't uncontroversial. Scott, what do you think Tel Aviv is hoping to get out of this visit? Might the actual visit, the presidential visit of someone like Joe Biden, boost Yair Lapid's profile ahead of the November elections there?
Well, I mean, certainly Yair Lapid, and indeed any Israeli politician, will try to get some type of mileage for domestic reasons ahead of the elections, provided being seen with Biden isn't too toxic. Yeah. But no, the overriding Israeli concerns are, let's keep the focus on Iran and who needs to talk about Palestine. And by that, I mean, of course, that there are no serious Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. There haven't been any of substance since 2014. And I would argue there haven't been any significant Israeli-Palestinian negotiations since 2009, the first year when Joe Biden was vice president. And Israel doesn't want that to change. Israel wants to maintain its autonomy, including over the occupied territories. They made a token gesture just today saying, all right, we'll delay, not cancel, but delay the building of some settlements in the West Bank. But pretty much Israel has the upper hand in Palestine, and no Arab state, let alone the United States, is going to challenge that at this point. And of course, what does Israel really want to talk about? They want to talk about this block to contain Iran. Some would argue push Iran back. And that, of course, is a block which has really been forged with the U.S. in a sense off to the side with Arab states such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
I want to get to some of those regional dynamics in a minute, but I do also want to talk about the peace process between Israel and Palestine, so-called peace process. The administration, the Biden administration, says it's still working towards that. Now, Khaled, I know you yourself have been involved in previous talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Now, given the current situation and the U.S. response to the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, how are the Palestinians actually viewing Joe Biden as the president at the moment?
Well, first of all, I think there's a deep sense of disappointment in the Biden administration on the part of certainly the Palestinian leadership, but much more so the Palestinian people, although expectations were already pretty low on that front. As far as the leadership is concerned, they were hoping for a much more proactive and engaged administration after 4 years of Trump that had really set back American-Palestinian relations to an unprecedented low. So far, most of the Trump legacy remains intact, with the exception of opening direct ties with the Palestinian leadership, restarting some aid to the Palestinians, which is something the administration frequently likes to play up. But other than that, the bulk of the Trump legacy on Jerusalem, on the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, on the closure of the PLO mission, and frankly, even on settlements, things like former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's policies to legitimize settlements, to treat products made in Israeli settlements as made in Israel, to do away with the term occupied territories. These are doing away with the legal memo on the illegality of Israeli settlements. All of these things are still on the books, and I think Palestinians are kind of scratching their heads and saying, why haven't these policies been reversed?
Well, let me bring Andreas in here. Andreas, as Khaled's been saying, it seems that the Biden administration has largely embraced a lot of the Trump-era policies. So was that a considered decision on the part of that administration, or has Biden just been distracted by a whole load of other issues?
Well, yes, he has been distracted, but I would say this administration is very clueless when it comes to foreign and security policy more widely, but particularly on the Middle East, it hasn't delivered. He's written an op-ed in the Washington Post this week or last week where it becomes quite clear that there isn't a strategy, there isn't a vision, there isn't something that America can actually deliver. And the problem is there's a growing say-do gap. And what I mean by that is what America preaches and what it actually does is becoming ever more overtly, that becomes an ever-growing discrepancy between these two things. And I think what we see, particularly on the issue of Palestine, is that there hasn't been a reversal on any of the Trump policies. There is actually a continuation of a path that has been going, has been set for decades already. And all we see is that presidents like Obama or Trump or Biden, they might have put an added different nuance to it. But at least Donald Trump was someone who was kind of as destructive as he was very overtly destructive, that you knew what you were getting. With Biden, there's a lot of ambiguity about, on one hand, saying we are interested in engaging with the Palestinians, we're interested in engaging with Iran. But when it comes to actually doing something about it, realpolitik is hitting. And that same is true for Saudi Arabia. A lot of narrative about human rights, conditionalities, but when it comes to actually delivering on it, there is a continuation of the status quo that is very, very much, very, very puzzling for both sides of the divide in the Middle East. Iran doesn't know what to expect. The Saudis don't know what to expect. UAE don't know what to expect. Israel doesn't know what to expect. And that sort of creates this ambiguity and a state of leaderless chaos in the region, which other people, have been willing to fill. Other nations have been willing to fill. Iran was able to act on as they see fit. UAE is acting as they see fit. We've got Russia and China moving in, where the Americans have withdrawn. The problem is, what does America actually want? And that's a question the Biden administration hasn't answered, in the same way that the previous two presidents haven't answered that question either.
Well, I'm interested in how U.S. politics actually relates to the region and how regional leaders are viewing the U.S., because I see Biden's approval rating at home is, just 33%? And a majority of Democratic voters are saying that he should not be on the ballot in 2024. So now, given the possible change of administration in not too long, Scott, how do you think regional leaders are actually viewing Biden?
Well, I've got a lot of contacts in Saudi Arabia who, from day one of the Biden administration, simply scoffed at Biden and his advisors. They had very bad relationship with Biden and the Obama administration, and they expected this to carry on. They see the Biden administration as being too weak on Iran. They see Biden as being too weak in general. And the Israelis, similarly, although Biden talks a lot about the primacy of Israel in the relationship, they don't necessarily see Biden as a strong leader, especially in the context of where the U.S. is with a divided domestic scene. But I think, and I agree with a lot of what Andreas says, but let me add one point just for discussion where I do disagree with him a bit. I don't think Biden and the administration are clueless here. I think they know what is going on in the Middle East, but I think they realize they don't have leverage. And by that, I mean, a few years ago, after Jamal Khashoggi was assassinated, probably on the orders of Mohammed bin Salman, there was leverage. The Turks wanted something to be done. Other countries were appalled by what was happening, and you could have acted then. Of course, Donald Trump didn't. Move forward to 2022, and the fact is that, well, three things, why the U.S. doesn't have leverage. First of all, it has been outflanked by the maneuvers between Israel and the Arab states. Secondly, it faces, as long as it puts its priority on containing Iran and doesn't reach a settlement with Iran over the nuclear program, then Saudi Arabia has leverage on that issue. And thirdly, is the question of the oil supply in the context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in a conflict which is likely to be protracted. So if your opponents have leverage, not your opponents, if your interlocutors have leverage, like the Saudis and the Israelis, you don't go in to antagonize them. Biden, in other words, is playing on the defensive, not because he's clueless, but simply because American power is not exactly very powerful in the current context of regional politics.
Well, one of the things that Biden has really come under fire for at home in the U.S. is this next stop on his trip, is Saudi Arabia. Khaled, you're sitting in the U.S. now at a very tricky time for Biden. How are U.S. voters viewing this whole trip?
Well, it's interesting because actually the polls show, even though usually the public is public opinion is pretty disengaged from foreign policy, but they generally like presidents to sort of lead on foreign policy matters. The polls currently that I've seen are showing quite a lot of disapproval for this trip. I think part of that the problem is most Americans, like I think many analysts in Washington and elsewhere, and diplomats and others, don't really understand the purpose of this trip. Is it a photo op? Is it about oil prices? The administration keeps telling us that it's not. Is it about domestic politics, sort of posturing with Israel ahead of a midterm election and using Israel to market its the administration's ties to Saudi Arabia as a way maybe to blunt criticism? You know, your guess is as good as mine. The American public simply doesn't understand. I mean, first of all, they don't really care about foreign policy, even though foreign policy directly affects their lives. Just have a look, of course, at oil prices and gas prices. The administration has not done a good job of explaining the linkage between these foreign crises and the situation back at home. And I think as a result, most Americans just don't understand, and as a result, end up kind of disapproving.
Well, as you say that, the White House has been dismissing criticism of Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia. Here's what National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan had to say about that.
When it comes right down to it, isn't this trip proof that strategic interests, including oil and gas, when it comes right down to it, are always going to override something like human rights?
America's values, human rights, are a strategic interest of the United States. So is energy security. So is stopping terrorism. So is seeking peace in a place like Yemen. So we are trying to do multiple things all at once, advance along a number of different tracks. One of those tracks is, in fact, ending the blank check policy. And as I said before, the basic thrust and purpose of our policy with respect to Saudi Arabia has been to recalibrate the relationship, but not rupture it. We have stayed true to that from the beginning of this administration.
Andreas, recalibrate, not rupture? Is that code for we need help with the oil price?
Well, yes, this is code, but I agree with what was said previously. There is no evidence whatsoever that this trip is going to make a difference on the oil price, on inflation. You know, we know that the Saudis and the Emiratis actually have reached somewhat the end of the line when it comes to their capacity. They will not want to buy in into their reserve capacity at this point. And even if they did, the millions of barrels that they could bring online per day will not make a huge difference to bring down the oil price at the pump. So all of that is kind of window dressing. I understand that obviously supply chains need to be taken care of, and obviously there is a huge concern that there is this pivot of the UAE and Saudi Arabia towards Russia and China, particularly because they are oil and energy and interdependent. Dependencies growing as the oil and energy interdependencies with America are actually going down. But at the same time, this trip will not do very much in that respect. I think what this is about is more about security. It's about creating a new alliance. And I think the rapprochement that we will, and I say rapprochement rather than normalization, but there will be a rapprochement announced between Saudi Arabia and Israel on some strategic matters. And I think that's going to be the kind of foreign policy win that Biden is looking for. But, you know, as the previous speaker said, the issue here is everyone is scratching their head about why is he doing this? What is there to win for the Biden administration? Because everyone will look right through it. I mean, recalibrating this relationship for what benefit? It benefits the Saudis, benefits the Israelis. But what does it really do for the Biden administration?
You talk about building this alliance, and I want to take a bit of a broader view here because this is all taking place within the context of a war that's raging on in Ukraine. Now, the US has obviously made no secret of trying to create a global coalition to counter Russian aggression there. So I was interested looking at some opinion polls in the Middle East, though. It seems that many more people and many more countries are more anti-American than they are pro-Ukraine. Scott, how much support is Biden actually likely to get for that agenda?
Well, I'm not sure if Biden will get a great show of support from the Middle East, but the purpose of this trip is to keep Arab countries from going to the other side. Hmm. Just as the U.S. did in its approach to India, where it was worried that India would become too supportive of Russia, indeed almost back the invasion, and work for months to prevent that happening. Part of this trip here is to try to limit the development of ties, which Andreas has written about, between Russia and Saudi Arabia over energy. Indeed, you had a Russian envoy who just recently was in Saudi Arabia. So I think from the standpoint of realpolitik, and look, human rights are expendable here. Ideals are expendable here. The idea here is to make sure not only Saudi Arabia, not only the UA, but indeed the entire Gulf area at least stays neutral in this conflict. And indeed begins, as it were, in quiet ways to sort of support the ongoing international coalition to push back on the Russian invasion. So I suspect in September, because it's being leaked from both sides, both from the Saudi side and the U.S. side, the Saudis will increase oil production in September. Mm. How much of that will buffer the domestic situation in the United States and help Biden before November's election? I don't know. But the increase in oil production by the Saudis will send a message, which is we're not dependent on Russia. We're not being held hostage by Russia. And that's a pretty important message at what may be a turning point in the Ukraine conflict, with Kiev beginning to score some success in the battlefield.
I was interested to see that Jake Sullivan, who's Biden's national security advisor, he also very recently revealed that intelligence agencies have decided that Iran was planning to aid Russia in its battle against Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Khaled, how might that shape conversations in the coming days, especially given the state of the talks around the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, obviously, Iran is going to be a big focus of this trip, both in Israel and in Saudi Arabia. So there's no question about that. Whether that means there's going to be some progress at some point on the Iran nuclear deal, that remains to be seen. So far, we haven't seen that. So again, I think this sort of plays into this question about that most people have about what is this trip really about? But if I could just sort of go back to the point that was raised earlier about human rights, I agree with I think it was Andreas who said there's this huge gap between what the administration says and does. And I think that is nowhere more evident than in this rhetoric about human rights. And frankly, whether we're talking about Israel or Saudi Arabia, both of their records on human rights are quite abysmal. And we're seeing the administration really give a pass, not just to those two regimes, but also others that will be attending the summit in Saudi Arabia, for example, like Egypt or Jordan. Mm-hmm. Egypt has an especially egregious record on human rights. There is a growing sense that this administration is really prepared to, I think, trade away human rights and democracy in a way that even the Biden administration didn't go as far.
I do want to give Andreas a very quick last word, because I'm curious, in one sentence, Andreas, what would you say a successful trip would look like?
There is no successful trip, because I would absolutely agree with everything that's been said at this point, is that this trip is going to be defined by a weak president and a weak United States that is unable to leverage whatever leverage they've left. And the say-do gap is just widening, and that leaves a credibility gap as well that are very easily be defined and filled by the Russians and the Chinese, who do authoritarian stability much better than the Americans. So at least they're very upfront and very direct about what they're doing.
We'll see how it all plays out in the coming days. Well, in the meantime, though, thank you to all of our guests, Khaled El-Gindi, Andreas Krieg and Scott Lucas. And thank you, too, for watching. Remember, you can see this program again anytime by visiting our website. That's aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, do go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also always join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Nastasia Tay, and the whole team here in Doha, bye for now.